Sports and statistics go hand in hand, but some of those statistics are more interesting than others. Each year, the Royal Statistical Society highlights some of the most compelling sports stats in its Sports Statistic of the Year competition. This year's winners are the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association in partnership with Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. Joining me, as always, is regular panelist John Baylor, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at Miami University. We have two guests joining us today. Jessica Hargreaves is the chair of the RSS's Statistics in Sports section. She's also a lecturer in statistics in the Department of Mathematics at the University of York. Her academic focus includes non-stationary time series analysis, wavelet analysis, and applications in sports analytics, such as cluster AFC. She also researches pedagogy, including peer-assisted learning and accessible course notes. Rob Mastrodomenico is a sports statistician and an active fellow of the Royal Statistical Society. He's been the chair of the Statisticians for Society Initiative since its inception in 2017. He's also an RSS Statistical Ambassador, which involves regular work with the media in assisting with their reporting of statistical issues. Mastrodomenico also works as Director of Data Science at Blue Crow Sports Group. Thank you so much for joining us today, Rob and Jessica.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Great, some drum roll, John.
Drum roll.
What is the sports statistic of the year?
Well, the sports statistic of the year was very much an England, UK-focused one, and it was about the Lionesses, so the England women's football team or soccer team, in their triumph in the Euros in 2025. So the sports stat of the year was 4 minutes and 52 seconds, which is the total amount of time the Lionesses led across the entire knockout stage of Euro 2025. So the Lionesses being the England women's national football team or soccer team.
What made that particularly compelling for the committee that chose this?
I think the number, especially in terms of like how many games would have been played for the Lionesses, and for them to that amount to be so short, I felt to us like it was actually stood out quite a lot from a lot of the other nominations that we had. So it was between all of us who were doing the actual review of this, it kind of instantly looked like something that would be a candidate for this and ultimately won.
So if this under 5 minutes of having led during this is so remarkable, what might we have expected for a team that was going to win the Euros? And I guess I wonder, going into this, was it a surprise that the Lionesses won, for those of us who did not follow this as closely as those of you in the UK did?
No, shall I give you a bit of the behind the scenes?
Oh, please.
That'd be great.
So the RSS ran this competition a few years ago, and we were talking as a committee about bringing it back. And the person in charge at the time said, oh, you know, it was December. I don't know if we've got time to turn this around. And I said, I've got the winner. We can turn this around because I've got the winner. I know what it's going to be. So I deliberately, that's why I said I was not on the panel choosing it, because I deliberately wanted to be one of the people that could suggest things, which we opened it out to our mailing list in the Royal Statistical Society for people to make their suggestions. So yeah, I compiled those and then sent them to Rob and the team to pick the winner. But this is what I had. Because so the Lionesses were your question was, were they expected to win? Well, they were the reigning champions, so they were one of the favourites, certainly. So it wasn't that's the surprise. You're right, it's the small amounts that's the surprise, because you would expect a team that wins a tournament would be obviously winning the games to get to the final and then win the final and, you know, dominating those games and being ahead. Well, this is in the knockout stages, which was how many games, Rob?
Three games.
Yep. So it's only, you got your game of football that's 90 minutes and then it might go to extra time. It might end up in penalties. And then for three lots of 90, even if it hadn't gone to extra time, only five of them were they actually ahead. So that doesn't look like it's some amazing winner that's dominated the competition and flattened everyone in their path. But the reason for me why I was so sure before you even ran the competition that this would be it was because I think if you were watching the tournament, this is what it was like. They were going behind or they were not you know, not beating teams, and there was this belief that they were going to do it and find a way. And I think this number being so small just really does reflect that tournament and their performance in that tournament, that they won it and the way that they won it. But yes, like I say, I'm biased, and Rob's the actual person that picked it totally independently. I did not tell them that this was the one.
I had no idea.
From me.
Just to follow on from what Jess said, I think that number, although the story of the tournament from those who are watching it would have felt like, you know, there were lots of big comebacks, lots of times, you know, England kind of just pulled it out and obviously won in the end. That number's still insanely small for what you would have expected in that type of tournament. And so, yeah, to me, you will see it this summer. We've got the World Cup over in your neck of the woods. But I would be surprised if we have something similar to this, just because it's so unlikely. And like Jess said, England were one of the favourites, as in that they had a good chance. It's not like they were an underdog who just battled back all the time. And they kind of played their way into the tournament. And over here in England, it was, you know, a huge thing for them to actually win it again, especially in the manner that they did.
Yeah, I find this remarkable. I mean, when I think about 4 minutes and, you know, 52 seconds, that's about what extra time is in one game anymore. Yeah. You know, that's injury time. Yeah. that's being added on. I was over last fall in London when they were celebrating this at the Battersea Power Station Mall. So seeing the tremendous excitement and energy, and I hadn't appreciated at that time that we were looking at this outcome that was just end of every game in the knockout stage, you know, securing victory. That's really cool.
And I think that the growth of like the women's game in England as a whole, I know it's very big in the US, but kind of tournament on tournament, it's just gained in popularity. And I think when you have games like this and performances like this, it helps grow it more. I mean, I'm sure Jess, you would agree with that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. In fact, actually, I've done a bit of work on looking at the numbers of people that go to football games and things after the wins and seeing, you know, after the tournament success and seeing if it makes a difference. So it definitely helps. But yeah, it was a big deal. And I should say, so there was a couple of it going to extra time and penalties in that mix as well. And based on the England men's team, England, you know, we don't super like penalties, but the England women's team are very, very strong at penalties. So actually it is a tactic for the Lionesses.
The vibe around that England women's team is very different to probably what our men's team have over here. It's very surprising. And they kind of came in with lower... They had a poor start to the tournament and grew into it. But that kind of the mania that you get over here when you probably see it in the news with people throwing their... plastic beer glasses when a goal goes in, which is very common celebration in England, that kind of grew and people get into it, which is, I think, somewhat different to what you get from the men's team sometimes.
So that was the winner. One of the other highly commended statistics also related to the Lionesses. So do you want to talk through that one?
Yeah, I can go for that. 16.2 million, and that is the peak TV audience of England's Euro final victory over Spain. It was the most watched moment of 2025, which is crazy to think. I mean, essentially the nation stopped to watch that game. And as we said just before, that growth of the women's game and the popularity to be the most watched moment of 2025 is, I think, is a very highly commended statistic.
So, you know, if we wanted to leave football for a bit, what were some of the other sporting statistics that kind of jumped out for you?
We had lots, and we aren't just like football centric. I don't know, Jess, do you want to take one or I can take one? I think I've got two.
Yeah, no. So like I say, I was collating these entries with, you know, a particular favourite already in my head. But then when this one came in, this was from somebody on our mailing list who suggested this one. So it came in and I thought, oh no, this could challenge the 4 minutes 52 seconds. So we're in tennis. And the number is 1651, 1,651. And it's in all the matches that Jannik Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz have played against each other, they've both won the exact same number of points. So if you collated all their games and all their matches together into one big fixture, it's dead even, 1651 each. And that was after, because they do the finals in November, December at the end of the year. So it was, I think they faced each other in that final. And by the end of that final, they were completely even. And I really liked this one because for me, the sports stat of the year is it's trying to distill an interesting story down to one number that successfully conveys all that complexity. And that the fact that there would be dead heat, dead equal on this number, to me, was doing just that. It was really encapsulating tennis in 2025. It's these two, they're the new rivalry after all the greats that have gone before, and they're dead even, and there's been some really good matches that have involved those two as well. So yeah, I really liked that one.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking with Jessica Hargreaves and Rob Mastrodomenico about the RSS's Sports Statistic of the Year.
Just as a quick follow-up before we get to the next commended one, in tennis, you got me thinking about this. How many matches did they play? That was sort of one question. What was sort of their history that they had of matches? Boy, I'm really being a nuisance here with these detailed questions as follow-up, so apologies for that. But the second one was, do you have any sense of what the typical number of points that are available in a match at a very high professional level?
I mean, on the points level, it would depend on your tournament and
sure.
What type of match it is, obviously, if it's a three-set match, if it's a five-set match, and that kind of relative difference between the players. And I think with this statistic, what it encapsulates is how close together these two players are and kind of what a rivalry we've got brewing here. You know, the kind of previous era of like Nadal, Federer, Djokovic, you know, to a lesser degree, Murray, who was in that mix for a while, that was a kind of peak tennis for a long time. And I think, you know, these two have kind of snuck on the scene and just taken over as these two new big hitters, and just have two players who are like so close in, as this number would imply, kind of ignites a bit of excitement in the game. And if you think in terms of how many points you have in any like single game, any single set, any single match, to get it exactly the same at that point is like, you know, is a degree of randomness in it, but it's very interesting. And it's one of those, like Jess said, it kind of ignites something in your imagination to kind of excite you about, you know, these two players, look how tight they are, look at this number.
Yeah, like it's someone a pair that you want to continue watching, because who knows what's going to happen, right?
Yeah, of course. And it's, you know, like in all sports, I think, you know, when you have these rivalries, something that kind of, you know, for a lot of us casually, we maybe aren't able to watch as much sport as we want, but you want those kind of big match feels, the big game, the big contest. And, you know, when these two are playing, you notice that people watch, and that's great. That's like we've had previously in tennis. And the number kind of implies like that level of importance when they're going to have a match, how tight this is. And sometimes people can't necessarily convey that, I think, just from being a casual watcher. But, you know, this could be one of the great rivalries going forward.
To answer your question, at that point in time, they'd played each other 16 times and Alcaraz was leading the head-to-head 10-6. So actually, the overall number of matches, Alcaraz's, it's not close. But when that's maybe not showing how close those matches were in themselves.
I'm curious if you've heard back from any of the winners or commended. Did you hear any of the representatives of the Lionesses, you know, respond when they found that sort of there were two aspects of their tournament that made the stat of the year, or if you've heard back from these two tennis players that they've, you know, they almost made it to the finals, but they
we've not heard back from them yet. However, at the RSS conference this year, we're going to have one of the analysts for the England women's football team on one of our panel discussions about the data gap with women's sport. So if they are not aware already of the fact that they are involved in two stats of the year, they'll know by the end of that conference. So yes, we've not heard from them yet, but you're absolutely right. I'll make sure I point that out to them when we have that chat.
So there is one more highly commended statistic, and I'm going to be honest, John and I are going to need a lot of talking through why this one is commended, because it involves cricket, and neither one of us really understand that sport very well.
I mean, I'll probably join you on that one as well. I'm joking. When we were kind of judging this, Pete, who was on our judging panel, was a huge cricket fan, and I think he didn't push it. It's an interesting statistic alone, but, you know, he's probably the biggest cricket fan that I know. And it's 67.3 overs, and not since 1904 have England survived so few deliveries in losing a test as they did in the first Ashes test in Perth. That probably means nothing to anybody.
what is an over? Like, do you can you explain that?
What is cricket?
Yes, please walk us through why this number matters.
The idea is, so an over, I believe, is six goes at bowling, you know, bowling at the batter. So it's cricket again, it's a bit like baseball in that there's no clock on it. It's just you go until, you know, everybody's out or that they've won. So it does have this idea that a game can be short. If you absolutely dominate and get them all out quickly, then it can be a shorter game. It's not going to go on for a set amount of time like the Lionesses did. So it's this stat basically is just that they got absolutely dominated by the other team and it was over very quickly. Mm. But the reason why this is an interesting one, like we say again, it's this idea that a number can encapsulate something. I think of the stat of the year as a bit of a time capsule for the year. Like we say, some of the things that we in the UK were talking about in 2025 were the Lionesses winning. It was the big rivalry in tennis. And it's this idea of something called Bazball, which is an approach to cricket, which means basically you go for it from the start. You start trying to hit it as far as you can. And as I say, I'm with you lot. When I heard that this was a controversial tactic in a sport, that you would actually go for it and try and hit lots of runs, I was a bit surprised and needed that explaining to me. But that's the point of this cricket. It's very, you know, they play it for a number of days. It's a slow moving game. It's about building things traditionally. And this thing called Bazball is ripping up that approach and just going for it and trying to hit score lots and lots of runs quickly. And like we're saying here, it can tremendously backfire and you can get out very quickly. So this stat is kind of showing that debate that people have. Those people, the traditionalists that were criticizing this way of playing, could point to something and go, well, look, historically bad result here in this Ashes test. Have I done a good job of conveying cricket?
Well, I was just about to blow their minds and say there are different types of cricket as well.
Oh, yeah.
So you can play kind of faster games. And this is like, test cricket is a kind of thing unto itself. And the Ashes is like such a big thing in the UK and Australia. But obviously a lot of these players play between different disciplines. So something like a 20-20, where it's a fixed time, fixed amount that you're going to follow, it kind of leans into what Jess says. And those have been developed to be kind of more exciting, quicker levels of cricket where you can go and watch it in a few hours. So, you know, it's interesting in, you know, essentially you've got these players who can play different types of cricket and will, you know, go between different areas like the IPL or the 2020 in England. And so, yeah, it's a fascinating sport unto itself and actually very enjoyable once you get into it. I am very partial to an evening game watching 2020 somewhere nice in London if I ever get the chance. So I would very much recommend it for you. But again, I like going to the baseball as well. Yeah. You know, that's all good fun.
Yeah, I mean, and I've watched it. I just don't always understand what's happening. But it's interesting, like these stats are so different. Like the winner, right, is this like triumph of, you know, English female footballers, right? And then this one is sort of the opposite of that. So it's a real yin and yang in that.
And I think there's probably an element from our side that actually it could have been either. It would have probably, when you're on the judging panel, really you're just looking for something that's most interesting, and actually the result at the end or what kind of came from that isn't as important as how that number conveys whatever happened, whether it was positive or negative. And I think in this instance we end up with like a really nice story for our stat of the year, but you know, this year it could easily be something that's not so enjoyable, especially with England in a World Cup, you know, that I'm sure could come out of that.
Heartbreak City, right?
Yeah. I'm Italian, so I'm already heartbroken, you know.
So I'm curious, what sports were kind of most represented in nominations this year? And what sports were least represented?
So I think essentially the way in which this is done is it's people nominating. So I can't remember off the top of my head all the sports, but I'm sure there was representation from American sports. There was definitely darts, cricket, tennis, football. Some of the others, there's a lot of other sports where necessarily the data in it is, it's probably less interesting. And so we don't get, I can't remember a Formula One type statistic of coming in. And I've done a few of these. But it will depend on essentially more so the statistic than the sport itself. If something interesting happens, it can be any sport.
So I was collating them and putting them together. I'm a bit interested to ask, actually, like I say, I've really enjoyed doing this podcast because I get an insight into what the judges are looking for. So I collected them by category because as they were coming in, it sort of did become apparent that people were getting at the same sort of thing. So we were seeing a lot for the Lionesses. We saw a lot for the, we also had the Women's Rugby World Cup in the UK that year as well. So there was a few on women's rugby as well. But yeah, the categories we got were athletics, baseball, basketball, cricket, as we've heard, cycling, darts, lots of football. As I say, Lionesses was their own category, really. There were loads for the Lionesses. And then, as I say, I put some of them together because I thought some of it was about visibility of sport. So that number of the 16 million watching the England women football, I felt that was more about, the visibility of the sport as opposed to the actual sport that was happening. So I put those into a category as well. But I have been thinking about whether we should have an international category as well. I think the RSS stat of the year has a UK stat and an international stat. I think maybe we should branch out and deliberately try and include things that are a bit more international.
I believe you have the authority to do that, Jess. Maybe that's less of a question, more of
democracy.
A declaration. Yeah?
Take it straight to the top.
That sounds like a declaration of what's going to happen in the upcoming years.
Hit it here first.
I wonder, given that the World Cup is happening, like what sporting events are you guys like anticipating being the big drivers of this in the next go around?
Like you say, I think Men's Football World Cup could feature heavily. Again, it might depend because our audience is quite UK-based. It might depend on how well the UK teams, because we've got Scotland as well, doing that. Of course, we've had the Winter Olympics. I'd really like to see something from the Winter Olympics because that's a super event. Yeah, they're the two on my list. Have you got any, Rob, that you're thinking people might?
I can't get... I'm still... A World Cup year for me is everything. So, life essentially is going to stop in the start of June. So nothing else on my mind. But one of the things I always think there's a surprise that will come. So like Jess said, the Winter Olympics I thought were brilliant this year. And I watched way more than I thought I would. But I can see another sport delivering something that we don't expect. In the UK, the darts are always interesting because they usually come around the time around when we're judging it, and you sometimes have some really interesting kind of statistics from there. But what I like about the whole statistic of the year is there will be something I didn't expect or something different that somebody saw that will just kind of raise, an eyebrow. And you're like, I didn't realize that, because we all have the sports that we like. And through the Royal Statistical Society, there are lots of people who are fans of very specific sports. So we get some really interesting stuff back. And I think, again, when we look at like the statistic of the year, it's trying to encapsulate what happened, but also to maybe shed some light on things maybe everyone didn't know. So, the cricket one for you guys, I think was interesting. You wouldn't have known that, but it kind of then perked your interest around a sport maybe you're not so familiar with. So I'm excited to see what comes.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Jessica and Rob, thank you so much for joining us today. I look forward to what wins next year. Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. You can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or other places where you find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.